Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Since the late 1970s, there has been a 15,000% increase in SWAT team raids in the United States. Tonight on SDPB TV, tune in for the feature documentary Peace Officer. It's a look at the increasingly militarized state of American police as told through the story of William Dub Lawrence. He founded the state of Utah's first SWAT team and then, 30 years later, was compelled to stand by and profess the professionalism of SWAT officers as they surrounded his son-in-law, who stood with a gun to his head in his own driveway. The controversial standoff culminated in the shooting of Dub's son-in-law, and Dub Lawrence became obsessed with uncovering the truth behind the shooting, with other officer-involved shootings, and with the shifting nature of the role of peace officers nationwide. We're joined now by filmmaker Scott Christofferson, director, producer, cinematographer for Peace Officer. Scott joins us from Utah. Scott Christofferson, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Hey, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
We also have with us Dub Lawrence, former sheriff of Davis County. He is currently a part-time private investigator. Dub Lawrence, welcome to Dakota Midday as well.
Thank you, from North Carolina.
From North Carolina, he is joining us today. Dub, let's start with you. 15,000% increase in SWAT team raids. Put that into some context for me. You were there with the origins of SWAT. What was its original intent?
Well, originally it was to give the well-trained professional law enforcement officers adequate tools and equipment, especially training in negotiating and defusing, neutralizing life-threatening situations. We had seen an increase in serious violent crimes in the late 60s, early 70s. We felt it was a good move in giving law enforcement officers the tools and equipment necessary to deal with most anything that we were encountering. And then over the next 35 years, we've seen so many changes that have happened in society that the SWAT teams have increased. And it's a very macho thing to do. I mean it's a very skilled. The officers have a lot of prestige by being a SWAT team member. The training and the discretionary power has evolved into something. The pendulum has swung too far out of kilter, to the point to where we are using SWAT teams to serve search warrants. We're using them for minor crimes, specifically drug-related crimes. And our since the war on crime and war on drugs and war on terror, these wars are declarations of war on these types of issues have just taken us as a society to the brink of severe danger to our criminal justice system. So we're hoping that we can, by raising this dialogue, having this kind of conversation nationwide, we can bring this back into some reasonableness, some point of sanity, so that our prisons are not bursting, so that the war on nonviolent crimes, with our prisons filled with so many nonviolent people, we can have a turn in that in the direction we're going. Hopefully, we can have some societal impact on this issue.
Dub, how quickly did the nature of SWAT and the elite officers develop its own mythology in the public consciousness? How fast did that start happening, where you started seeing TV shows and sort of the romanticization, that's not a word, sort of, you know what I mean?
I wasn't aware during the time that I actually was in charge of the SWAT team operations. We diffused a number of life-threatening situations. We were very proud of the fact that our officers and deputies were trained in hostage negotiation and mental health issues, where good public relations, being able to deal with people on a common effort to try to not have an injury or a death on either side, either a police officer or a civilian. And I'm very proud of the fact that we didn't kill anybody. My SWAT team has never killed anybody. And we served over 16,000 warrants during the course of the years that I worked in law enforcement, and we never had an officer injured or killed, and we never had a civilian injured or killed, to my knowledge. So there is a right way to do it. Kicking in doors in the middle of the night with guns drawn and automatic or semi-automatic handguns with red dots on people's chests and their heads, and you know, with babies in bedrooms, and I mean, it's just to me a violation of the fundamental principle of our Constitution that guarantees no unreasonable searches and seizures. To me, that's unreasonable. That's not the way to have a good outcome, and the likelihood of a disaster or a tragedy or some unnecessary loss of life is increased, you know, exponentially, as if we approach it the way we are doing today. And to try to explain it in our country as how we got to this point, the only thing I can say is our mentality has changed to more of a fear factor than reasonable and prudent and good judgment and good public relations and respecting people and honoring the code of ethics that I swore to and adhered to as a law enforcement officer the way I was trained. So that's probably my take as succinctly as I can state it.
Scott, tell me how you first met Dub Lawrence and what your first impressions of him were.
Yeah, so I met Dub kind of happenstance. I was playing a softball game with Dub's son, visiting family in Utah, and Dub approached me. He owns a septic tank business or a pump business, and he had his name tag on that said Dub, and he said, "Hey, I want you to teach me how to edit." He knew I was a film professor, and then he took me back to his place of business, where he also has an airplane, and showed me a two-hour-long analysis of his son-in-law's shooting death, and I was really blown away by what he had done. He had spent 4 years of his life just picking apart what happened in that SWAT raid, and he's very meticulous. He's also a very lovable guy, very easy to love, and he's very charismatic. And so I was drawn to him. You know, it seemed like he almost smiled a bit too much all the time. But I didn't know much about the militarization of police, frankly, nor much about the topic, and really was just compelled by Dub. You know, this guy who really is fixing septic tanks by day and then solving crimes by night. You know, really fascinating character.
And that smile is memorable for sure. In the beginning of the film, it takes you right away into, and then there's a seriousness that appears quite quickly. Dub, tell me more about the raid. September 22nd, 2008 is what I have. Brian Wood is your son-in-law. And immediately after his death, you're able to sort of take over the scene and do some investigation of your own. What do you want to say about the moments after Brian's death?
Well, it was quite unusual for the police to actually release the crime scene within 22 hours of the shooting of my son-in-law. They hadn't actually collected all the evidence. They left quite a number of different types of rounds that were fired at Brian. With everything that the police collected and everything that I was able to collect afterwards, there was actually, we counted 111 different types of weapons and rounds, including the tasers and the flashbangs and the non-lethal rubber bullets and impact rounds and gas rounds. And, you know, so they pretty much mutilated Brian in an assault to try to take him down. And in the process, apparently one of the SWAT team officers fairly recently graduated from a sniper school and wasn't really prepared or equipped or uniformed, or, you know, he apparently thought it was a takeout and touched off a .308 sniper round from 38 feet, which was the fatal instantaneous death.
And at the moment that round is fired, Brian is unarmed and on the ground, correct?
Yes. And but that wasn't what was released. What shocked me more than anything was the police released for 20 hours they put out the information that it was a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the chest. Mm-hmm. And we knew that was not true. There were many witnesses, family members. I was there personally, witnessed, watched, heard, and knew that was not correct, and was devastated when I realized that millions of people were getting five television stations broadcasting that it was a suicide. The self-inflicted gunshot wound to the chest, when they actually shot him twice with lethal bullets and numerous times with non-lethal and less, you know, what they call non-lethal or less lethal weapons, that any one of them could have been fatal if they'd hit in the right place. But in any case, it was the misinformation that really shocked me at first, which set me into a course of trying to learn the truth about what actually happened. And it took us 2 years and 7 months to get the actual footage from the films, that the two cameras that the police had taken, pole camera videos, and already had five TV vantage points from five different TV perspectives from 300 and 400 feet away. But the police cameras were much closer, and we included that footage in peace officer. I mean, when Scott and Brad saw the footage and the analysis and was able to, actually a lot of the footage in peace officer is actual police footage taken by police cameras that were that was initially redacted or kept from the public and from the family through grammar requests, Freedom of Information Act, and using every angle that I could use with all the contacts that I had accumulated over the years in my profession. I was able to gather that information and share it with Scott and Brad, and they were incredible in putting together that information in a way that was fair to all the participants. So the film itself is credited to great extent, actually, to fair treatment of the subject. So, Scott, you can take it from there.
Scott, give me an idea of how you made some of those decisions as far as what to include, because there is a lot of video footage that's quite authentic and difficult to watch at times. Why was it important to include the real footage and the real photographs from fatal injuries, for example?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons we included some of that footage and some of those images, you know, we want to show what it was really like to be either a police officer that's going in on a SWAT raid, or be on the receiving end of a SWAT raid gone wrong or right. And really, for us, it was important that we get all sides. Like Dub said, we strived for balance, and part of that balance meant we got police officers who have been on SWAT raids, who know what it's like to talk about it firsthand, talk about what it's like to be shot at. Mm-hmm. And I think we have a deep respect for law enforcement people, you know, like Dub, who he himself was in law enforcement for years. And so, you know, part of our justification was, or what we tried to do was to get as many officers as we could who were in the cases that we covered in the film, and really be open-minded and let them speak for themselves. And I think that leads to maybe a better discussion, a place where we can really empathize. You know, having empathy for all sides was really important to us, and I think that's the power of documentary, is you're able to spend time with and empathize with the characters in the film.
Yeah, Scott, there are clearly some underlying problems, because you weren't dealing with officers who were just acting on their own. So what were some of those underlying problems with sort of how SWAT is implemented that you were able to sort of pick up on thematically?
Yeah, I think one of the shocking things that you see in the film is that SWAT raids have increased 15,000% since the 1970s. And to throw out another number, about 80% of all SWAT raids now today are used just to carry out search warrants, you know, where they really were set up to defuse active shooter situations. And Dub will tell you, you know, he served, when he was a police officer, when he was sheriff, he served 16,000 warrants, never a fatality, never an officer injured. And so now what's happening is SWAT teams are used to carry out search warrants, and they're taking
you know, violent gun situations to nonviolent situations to nonviolent drug crimes. And I think Dub is an example to show that, oh, this can be solved without having a drug raid. You know, you can solve it in the middle of the day, and use surveillance or use research to find a more passive way to combat the situation.
Dub, what are some of the first steps to changing this into a direction that makes more sense?
Well, first of all, the concept of no unreasonable searches and seizures has pretty much been trashed with the war on drugs. The use of SWAT teams for kicking in doors in the middle of the night as investigative tool to gather evidence on possible drug crimes, to me, is not a proper use of police authority certainly not to create a situation where an officer can qualify for immunity after killing somebody unnecessarily. I don't want to generalize too much there, because I do feel strongly that there are many times, many cases, instances where we do need officers equipped and capable of using deadly force to stop someone who is, or even groups of people who are terror, you know, terrorists, mm-hmm. or people who are doing things that justify using deadly force to protect the innocent. There's no question about what that capability needs to be there. But we have gone way, way too far off course by allowing deadly force. You know, when you point a gun at somebody and put a red light on their chest or their forehead, that's a scary situation to be in. I mean, when you put a person's life in danger and you got 10 guys with those beacons pointed, you know, just when somebody opens the door, they're looking down the barrel of deadly, you know, instantaneous death. If one of those people is nervous or touches off a round, it just creates a situation that it places lives in danger that it should take time. It should take a chance. I realize there are times when you have to cover yourself. You have to be protective. But these, as a general rule, policy, procedure, protocol today, allows an officer to approach someone with their lives hanging in the balance, with the only thing from death, instantaneous death, is a hairy finger or a nervous or a thought in the mind of an officer. The only thing he has to do is move his finger and somebody's dead. That resorting to creating a situation with deadly force in so many situations that are not even an imminent danger present, the police have already escalated the situation to a potential loss of life just by setting it up that way. So I would go back to changing the way, the mentality, the policy, protocol, the procedure, so we get away from this paranoia, this fear factor.
So, Dub, you're also a man who gave yourself a parking ticket back in the day. So talk a little bit about accountability, you know, when situations go wrong. How do we protect our officers, make sure they can do their job, but hold them accountable for exercising good judgment? Where's the balance there?
Well, that adds another factor, and that's equality under the law. I think the reason that most people are offended, and there are so many people that are lashing out at the police today, is because the police have qualified immunity. Lawyers have, the county attorneys, prosecutors, judges, legislators, have absolute immunity. They've been given immunity from prosecution. So most of the time when we see an officer use bad judgment, kill somebody unnecessarily, they get administrative pay they leave with pay, which amounts to a paid vacation until they go back to work, exonerated, after a prosecuting attorney, county attorney, district attorney, who is on the same team, basically, with the police side of the adversarial system, makes a determination as to whether or not the officer was justified or unjustified in acting under the law. I take issue with the law that allows the attorney to make that discretionary charge in the first place, because that's not due process. The Constitution very clearly states that no state can pass or enforce any law that takes away or deprives any person of life, liberty, or property without due process. And so it's not guilt or innocence in a courtroom with a judge and jury that the officer has to face like a common citizen. It's an attorney with the power, discretionary power, to make that determination. And where the common citizen goes to prison and the officer is exonerated and goes back to work and gets his back pay, the injustice is given rise to a tremendous backlash. You know, we're getting blowback from the entire nation, and by the thousand, actually 1,200 times a year now, where officers are killing civilians. And in our case in Utah, in the last 8 years, I've looked at 29 cases, and five of those cases were problematic, where the officers had no reason whatsoever to resort to deadly force. It was a misunderstanding or a miscalculation or a misjudgment that resulted in somebody's death. And in one or two of these, were the people were not armed and not causing any danger or threat to the officers. They perceived a threat. They thought they saw something, and they were already, you know, to the point of just touching the trigger, and which ends somebody's life. And then they realized that the person wasn't armed and was no danger, was no threat. A little 21-year-old girl shot to death in her car, and even though the prosecutor filed charges against the officer for manslaughter, still that immunity qualification comes to play, where the officer goes to preliminary hearing, and it becomes obvious that you can't use the evidence against him because he's qualified for immunity. And so the officer, the case is dismissed, and he goes back to work. And the only thing left is for the people to try to spend more money to try to get a civil case, you know, and try to get some of the truth out there so that the world can learn the truth. And so that's been our challenge the last 8 years that I've worked on these cases and in several states now. And I see that quite prevalent, more so than we would want to admit, or more often than we would like to acknowledge. I wish we didn't have it. And officers are, I see it everywhere, where they're actually feeling like that there is an adversarial system out there now. It's us against them. And we bring bigger weapons because the violent criminals have bigger weapons. And so we're escalating, like the Cold War, you know, the nuclear arms race, you know, with guns and equipment and militarization, and so we're fast approaching a police state.
Scott, one more question for you, Scott. In the film, Dub says he's obsessed with the idea of a peace officer being a trusted friend, qualified, trained peacemaker, and he believes that to be possible. After putting this film together and spending time with all the different resources that you did, do you feel that that's possible to go back to a time where a peace officer is a trusted friend?
I do. I like Dub, I have that hope, and I think, you know, Dub's optimism has kind of bled into me. You know, I think that it is possible. I think police can find new ways to approach situations, and I think it goes even broader than that. I think that really we need to call on lawmakers to fight these issues, you know, to change putting. Because really what's happening is we're putting the lives of officers and citizens at stake. You know, we're unnecessarily causing officers to lose their lives, I think, and that's because of the laws that allow for search warrants to be used, or SWAT raids to be used for search warrants. And so, you know, I think a lot, the majority of officers are good people who are trying to do their jobs, and I think we need to find ways to protect them as well as citizens, and also train them better. I think, you know, one of the first things I noticed was
when money's tight in a lot of these situations in various cities, the first thing to go is training of officers. Mm-hmm. And I think we really need to dedicate more resources to giving them the ability to work through some of these situations, you know, so that they can have skills to work with those who might have mental illness, things like that as well.
If you're just joining us, the film is called Peace Officer. It's on tonight, SDPB TV, 8 p.m. Central, 7 o'clock Mountain Time. Scott Christofferson, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate you joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dub Lawrence, thank you as well for your time and insight.
Well, thank you for giving us a microphone and a voice in the issues. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.